So the chapter begins with a reference to King Belshazzar. And before we jump into the whole story here, let's talk for a moment about this particular person. Now, you probably remember that early on in the different studies in Daniel, we talked about how Daniel has been highly criticized by liberal scholars. They have denied that this book was actually written by a 5th century BC person named Daniel. They want to attribute it to somebody in the Maccabean period, which was about the 160s BC. And you might wonder, well, why would they do that? Well, they do it for this reason, because they don't believe in the supernatural. Now, just understand this. There are Christian theologians. Now, I say Christian lightly here. They identify as Christian theologians who do not believe the Bible. I mean, that's pretty darn amazing, but it is a fact. It just seems like such a contradiction. I mean, why would you even be a Christian theologian if you didn't believe the Bible? But so there are such people, and there have been such people for a long, long time. And so there are these certain theologians, many of them are dead now, but there are still plenty of them around today, who have a presupposition that there is no, that miracles just do not happen. And one of the miracles that they would see not being able to happen is predictive prophecy. Now, because Daniel, if Daniel is indeed a 5th century BC prophet, then that means he is predicting future events, and his predictions are completely accurate. But that's too much for the liberal theological mind. So they say, no, these can't be predictive prophecies. These have to be just historical recordings. So somebody in, like I said, the 160s BC, they came along and identified themselves as a Daniel. And they wrote this stuff down, which was now history. That's why it's so accurate. Now, one of the things that this group said unequivocally, that there was never a Babylonian king named Belshazzar. That they just absolutely so. This claim here in the fifth chapter, or the statement in the fifth chapter, is erroneous. There's nothing historical about it. It just never happened, and it proves that the Bible is an unreliable document. That's what they said. In 1850, there was a prominent theologian who made that statement. Now, as God would have it, just 4 years later, a man who was doing some archaeological excavation in this area of what we know today as Iraq, he discovered these little cylinders on which, in cuneiform, they wrote, this cuneiform was written on these cylinders that were made of clay or some material like that. And he found these cylinders that referred to, for the first time, there was a reference to Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus. Now, Nabonidus is the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. So here's the first historical reference or reference outside of the Bible to Belshazzar. So, okay, they can't argue that there was no such thing as a Belshazzar, but now what they argue is that he was never king. He was never king, so Daniel's references to him being king are wrong. Because we've got ancient records of the kings of Babylon, and Belshazzar was not named among them. But then once again later, documentation was found that Belshazzar was what you call a co-regent with his father. And his father, Nabonidus, wasn't all that into Babylon itself, so he left Babylon for a 10-year period and moved to northern Arabia and lived his life there. And when he left, he put Belshazzar in charge. So this was discovered. That's why, as we're going to see in a moment, when all of this stuff comes down that happens with Belshazzar in his court, and Daniel comes before him, and Belshazzar is offering to anyone who can interpret what's going on to make them the third ruler in the kingdom. Why the third ruler? Why not the second ruler? Because Belshazzar was the co-regent, and his father was actually still the king. So he couldn't make him second in the kingdom, but he could make him third in the kingdom. So all of this to say, and I am more convinced of this than I've ever been in my life. And I've been a Christian now for a long time, and I've read the Bible a lot, and I've studied it, and I've studied the critics and all of that. These days, I am just so confident in what the scriptures say is exactly what happened. And these days when I even hear, you know, new criticisms, there aren't that many. It's kind of always recycled stuff. It doesn't even faze me. It's like water off a duck's back. It's just like, well, that's ridiculous. Because the biblical text can be trusted. And these kinds of things, these kinds of denials of historical accuracy and things, these have come and gone over and over again throughout the centuries, and there's always a point where they are refuted by the evidence. And I think it was somebody like Josh McDowell, he might have been quoting somebody else, but he put it like this: every time an archaeologist's spade goes into the dirt, a liberal theologian is buried. And I think that that's a pretty accurate evaluation of the situation. So now, I don't know if you're going to run into somebody today that's going to try to convince you that Daniel is not really Daniel, as the scripture says, that Belshazzar didn't really exist and things like that. But, you know, you might. And so if you do run into somebody like that, you can give them the facts. All right. So King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. So King Belshazzar threw an amazing party. 1,000 of his nobles. This must have been like the party to beat all parties. Now, think about this. What the text doesn't tell us, but what becomes obvious at the end, is that Belshazzar threw this party when the city of Babylon was under siege by the Medes and the Persians. But Belshazzar was so cocky and self-confident, that he didn't believe there was any way that they could penetrate the city. So he was going to show his lack of concern over being in any danger by just, hey, let's have a party. Who cares what the Medes and the Persians are doing? They'll never get in here. This city is impenetrable. That's what he thought. So while Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father. So when it says his father, just understand his grandfather. The Hebrew language doesn't really have a word for grandfather. So, but that's who Nebuchadnezzar would have been to Belshazzar, his grandfather. And he had taken these gold and silver goblets. He had taken them, Nebuchadnezzar did, as we know. He took them from the temple in Jerusalem. So Belshazzar calls for those that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, they drank from them. So, you know, if you think about it, I mean, this is just this, you know, this is this grand, grand event. These are all of the important, powerful, elite people in the kingdom. And they're all together and they're all partying and they're all drinking. And at some point, Belshazzar gets this insane idea that we ought to get those vessels that my grandfather took from the temple in Jerusalem. So in his drunken state, he is moving toward blasphemy. He's being moved toward blasphemy. He's going to mock by taking these holy vessels and by toasting to the Babylonian gods. He's mocking the God of Israel. Now, maybe he's doing this again because of the Persian threat. Maybe he's wanting to remind everybody about the greatness of Babylon and the fact that, hey, nobody's going to conquer us. We're the ones who conquered everybody else. And these goblets, they remind us of our victory over Jerusalem and over the gods of the Hebrews. That's how they would have thought of it, or over the God of the Hebrews. So who knows exactly what's going on in his mind, but somehow he's emboldened to call for these vessels. Now, as they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So this is just a drunken, blasphemous orgy. That's what's going on. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall. I mean, can you imagine what that would have been like? You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this today. So, of course, while the people of Israel are in the land, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, northern kingdom, remember, goes into captivity before the southern kingdom. But while they're in the land, all of the clearly divine activity that's happening in the world is happening in that place and with those people. You have the prophets. The prophets are prophesying, and, you know, of course, they've got the long history of God's intervening and working miraculously in their midst and all of that. But I was thinking about now that the people are out of the land and they're in Babylon. Now, of course, the Lord is everywhere. He's omnipresent, but he keeps showing himself to be there with them because he keeps showing up among the Babylonian kings and in their courts through the different dreams and through the appearance in the fiery furnace and all of that. And so Now, Belshazzar was not a real smart guy. He should have put all of these pieces together and thought, yeah, let's party and you know, let's get some vessels from Dagon's temple, or let's get some vessels from Baal's temple, but let's not touch the Yahweh stuff. That's what he should have understood, but obviously he didn't. And so suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned, let's just say, sheet white, pale. He was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking together. Wow. And rightfully so. Man, what a moment that must have been. What an incredible moment. And let's just say this, and then I'll say a little bit more about it in a minute. But, you know, this just reminds us of how easily God can just disrupt what human beings are doing and make his sovereignty known, make his greatness known. It's not a problem for him to do this. He can do it anytime, and he does it right here. And what a creative way, just the there's no body connected to it. It's a hand. And it's writing in the plaster on the wall. The plaster is not wet plaster. It's dry. But he's writing, etching. But remember, the finger of God etched the commandments in the stone as well. And remember, in the New Testament, the finger of God wrote in the dirt as well. And so Belshazzar is freaked out, to say the least. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to these wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. So seems like the queen wasn't here. Now, the queen could either be his mother, could also be his grandmother. So Nebuchadnezzar would have died about, at the most, maybe 15 years before this. But could have even been a less amount of time than that. From the time of Nebuchadnezzar's death to the reign of Nabonidus, three other kings that reigned, but their reign was so brief. One was 2 years, one was 4 years, and one was 3 months. So basically about 6 years passed before Nabonidus comes to the throne, and then Belshazzar and he, you know, probably after some time, they develop this co-regency. So it could be his grandmother. And it seems like it might be, because she knows stuff that evidently Belshazzar, well, he would have known it, but he forgot it. So she says, "May the king live forever. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale." I was wondering about the translation of that. How do you stop yourself from looking pale? You know, but there must be some translation thing there. And then she says this, "There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him." Isn't that interesting? There is a man in your kingdom. You should know this. Belshazzar. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your grandfather, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your grandfather, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. Wow, man, what a rebuke from Grandma. She's like, call for Daniel. It's now, notice the closeness between the names Belshazzar and Belteshazzar. So Belteshazzar was, of course, the name given to Daniel by Nebuchadnezzar. And the names mean virtually the same thing. There really isn't any real distinct difference. So in a sense, you have two people called Belshazzar or Belteshazzar here. But it's interesting that, to me, that the grandmother is using his Hebrew name, not his Babylonian name. Call for Daniel. And that would make sense when we think back about what happened with Nebuchadnezzar. And as we saw in the story of Nebuchadnezzar, I think we would probably all agree, this is how I feel, Nebuchadnezzar had a genuine conversion to faith in Yahweh. And so this queen seems to also have at least that very high regard for Daniel and Daniel's God. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my grandfather the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Now, Daniel is apparently in some sort of retirement at this point. And so maybe, at the death of Nebuchadnezzar, he was finished in his duties in the court. And now he's in some sort of retirement. But remember, Daniel was like a really close friend of Nebuchadnezzar. So Daniel was a friend of the most powerful man in the world. So as Belshazzar's offering him this position, it's like Daniel's like, what are you talking about, kid? You know, this is not impressive to Daniel. And he makes that clear. Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. I'm not interested in a gold chain or in being the third ruler in the kingdom. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." Wow. So here we go again. Here's Daniel. Daniel, who has had to tell the king in the past bad news, and he didn't draw back from doing it, even though, remember, he didn't want to do it out of his affection for Nebuchadnezzar. Nevertheless, he didn't recoil in fear. He boldly proclaimed to him what the message from God was. And so he is going to do the same thing here. "And so, Your Majesty, the Most High God gave your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, All the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. This was the greatness of Nebuchadnezzar. He was the ultimate authority in the empire. In the next chapter, we're going to see the Medes and the Persians as they take over. The king makes a decree, but the king of Persia is not able to reverse his decree because there's a law of the Medes and the Persians that says that he can't. Nebuchadnezzar had no such law. He was the law. He was the final word in Babylon. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. Now here's the word to Belshazzar. But you, Belshazzar, his son or grandson, have not humbled yourself. Have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. That is the great offense of Belshazzar. He knew all of this. He knew what happened to his grandfather. He knew the story. And with that in mind, he calls for the vessels and he toasts to the false gods. And so Daniel says, you knew this and you did not do what your grandfather did, who was far superior to you in greatness. You did not humble yourself. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. Wow. You have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. Think about all of the rulers of the world who have set themselves up against the Lord of heaven. And we've got a bunch of them today, all around the planet. All kinds of rulers set themselves up against the Lord of heaven. And we've had this kind of situation throughout all of human history. But they've all been cut down. They've all been mowed down like the grass. And all of the present ones will be as well. You know, I often think about rulers, you know, powerful people, oftentimes wicked people, people who oppress and abuse and mistreat and murder and, you know, all of the things they do. And little do they know that in an instant, they will be cut down themselves, and then they will be judged for that. But these events remind us of that, that there's no one that escapes this. You know, there's a passage in Isaiah where Isaiah is talking about these rulers, these wicked rulers, and he says that, they just come to power. They just get themselves established. They just are there thinking that they have got it all under control, and suddenly they're cut down like the grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, and all flesh is like grass. And so, you have taken the goblets from his temple. And you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines, drank wine from them. You praised the God of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, and wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor God, who holds in his hand your breath and all your ways. Wow. Wait, Belshazzar might say, wait, no, I serve Bel. I serve Marduk. Daniel says, the God of heaven holds your breath in his hand. You are sustained. Your very existence is a result of this God that you've blasphemed. Wow. The God in whose very hand your breath is. Belshazzar, you couldn't take a breath were it not for God's allowing you to do it. Your breath and your whole life are in his hand. And Belshazzar had no idea. He didn't think that that was the case at all. And again, people today, that doesn't even come into their minds. They don't think about that. They don't think that their very life itself, their breath is given to them as a gift by God. They don't think in terms of accountability. You know, Karl Marx famously said that religion is the opiate of the people. And what he meant by that was that religion dulled the minds of people to allow others to oppress them. And so he wanted to rid the world of religion, to bring people out from under the delusion, so they would rebel against their oppressors, rebel against the rulers. Religion is the opiate of the people. They use it to try to escape from reality. John Lennox famously said, atheism is the opiate of the people. They use it to try to convince themselves that there is no judgment. You know, this is just on my mind because I've been thinking about it a little bit. You know, just understand this with the atheist. Atheism is driven by one thing. Really, one thing drives atheism. It is the refusal to believe that they are accountable to somebody beside themselves. That is the driving force behind atheism. That's why the atheist will come up with the most absurd ideas and cling to absurd ideas and promote absurd ideas, all in an effort to escape from judgment. Aldous Huxley put it this way. He said, we did not embrace Darwin because of the scientific irrefutability of his theory. We embraced Darwin because it gave us a way to live without the fear of a judgment. That's atheism. That's what it is. So when we hear people today, you know, talking about how there is no God and mocking people who believe in God, that's their drug. That's the heroin that they're shooting into their brains to numb themselves so they don't have to think about a judgment day. But as sure as Belshazzar had a judgment day and Nebuchadnezzar had his judgment day, which humbled him and turned him to acknowledge the God of heaven, just as, you know, whoever you want to think about in history, just as they had a judgment day, the rulers of today have a judgment day coming as well. And the future rulers, whoever they might be. And we know that there's a final ruler that's going to come. We commonly call that person the Antichrist. And one of the things the Bible makes clear is that the Antichrist has a judgment day. And that the Lord will slay him with the breath of his lips and destroy him with the brightness of his coming. And all of the power that he will amass to himself will be nothing when Jesus comes. He will be destroyed without a fight, basically. So, Daniel says, because you didn't honor the God who holds your breath in his hand, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. Meeny, meeny, tekel, parson, or Paris. One's plural, one singular. So here's what was written on the wall. Numbered, weighed, divided. That's what was written on the wall. Number, weighed, divided. It was written in the language that everybody could read, but nobody could interpret it. Nobody knew what it meant. That was the dilemma. The wise men, nobody could figure it out. It was like a riddle. It was a mystery. What does this mean? Numbered, weighed, and divided. Here's what these words mean, Daniel said to the king. Meaning, numbered. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Wow. Tekel. You have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Wow. Now here's the thing that's crazy. Look at this. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck. He was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Babylonians, was slain. Wow. So, a Greek historian writing not too long after the fall of Babylon told the story of how the Medes and the Persians penetrated the city. The city was impenetrable. I mean, you know, there's different estimations on the height of the walls, but the walls were, you know, some people say 90 feet high, some people say they were 300 feet high. And you know, it would have seemed to anybody looking on that there's nobody that's ever going to get in here. And Belshazzar would have, in some sense, rightly thought that he was fine. He could party all night and he didn't have anything to worry about. Nobody was going to penetrate those walls. Nobody was going to make their way in. But what they discovered is that the way the water came into the city was through these tunnels. And so what they did is they dammed up a portion of the river that opened up the tunnels. And so they came into the city through these tunnels. And they took the city from the inside out. And Belshazzar was slain that night. And then it says, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So there it is. Darius the Mede. Now, there's another name that we find in this context, and that name is Cyrus. Cyrus the Persian, he's called. This person's called Darius the Mede. So this has created some confusion among historians and even Bible translators, because again, there hasn't been any clear way to identify Darius, even up to this point. So when you think of Babylon being taken, and the prophecy in Isaiah 45 would be that Cyrus would take the city. And so probably the best way to sort it out is that Darius, we're told right here, Darius is 62 years old. So, you know, he's not a young guy. And it seems that at this stage, probably Darius and the Mede aspect of the empire, they were the more established ruling group. And Cyrus, although, you know, maybe ruling together with him, was probably more the military power, the leader of the general of the army that invaded. And we know that Cyrus did become the king as well. So we don't know the details of it, but there's easy ways to solve the problem. Again, the liberal mind is just throw it all out because it doesn't make sense. Therefore, it's can't be God's word. When if you just think about it a little bit, there's many, many ways that this could have been as it's described here. So now, as we finish up, just a couple things to think about. Remember last time we talked about God's sovereignty. And again, here we see it. And this is one of those things that if we can really lay hold of the truth of the sovereignty of God, it is so comforting. The sovereignty of God is meant to give us peace. Because lots of things happen in life and lots of things happen in the world that we don't have any control over. And many times they're bad things. They're not good things. But if we keep in mind that God really is in control, He's so in control that He holds the breath of Belshazzar in His hand. Belshazzar doesn't even acknowledge Yahweh, but Yahweh holds His breath in His hand. And what we have to learn to do, and I think probably more so in these days than maybe previous times and previous generations of believers, and even in some of our own lifetimes as Christians, we have to learn to trust God even when everything around us is in turmoil and chaos, and when it doesn't look like there's any immediate deliverance or solution to the problems. And when evil people get in power, because evil people get in power, they do. And we don't understand that. And I think sometimes we just think that, well, of course, God's not going to let that happen. But the truth of the matter is that happens over and over and over and over again in history. And God's people are not exempt from those kinds of oppressions. God's people aren't exempt from the policies and all of the wrong-headed things that are implemented by evil people. We suffer those things as well. And what we have to remember is that God is actually still in control. And God is working through these things. Because most of the time, I'm like this. You're probably like this too. I'm mostly concerned about how these things affect me and the people that I care about, the people that I love. And I don't too often think about the bigger picture. But what you come to realize is that God is working on a global scale. And God's program is to establish His kingdom. That's what His program is. And He's promised us that we are part of that kingdom. But the kingdom has not yet come. The kingdom has partially come. We're part of it. The kingdom of God is within us. We experience it to some degree now, but the fullness of the kingdom is coming in the future. And we know that before the fullness of the kingdom is established, there's much difficulty ahead for the human race and for planet Earth. But in all of those things, God is sovereignly working out His purpose. So my point is this: we have to learn to trust in that. We have to learn to say, God, I don't understand this. This doesn't make sense to me, but I'm not you. That's why I don't understand it. My understanding is so minuscule as to not even register on the meter of understanding. I know very little about everything. I know very little. God knows everything. And God knows what he's doing. And he's working out his plan. I remember reading a book. And the book was written by a guy named Patrick Johnston, who was a missionary to Malawi, Africa, at one time. But he wrote the book that we've used it and encouraged it as a prayer book at time to pray around the world. Operation World is the book that he originally wrote. And Operation World is a kind of a look at all of the different nations, gives you all the statistics and background about the culture and religion and all of that stuff, and then gives you things to pray about for those various nations. But anyway, in another book that he wrote, he talks about, and he's actually quoting and referencing people who live through like these great atrocities. And I remember he was referring, he was quoting a woman who had lived through the massacre in Rwanda. In Rwanda, they had like it was kind of a civil war, but it was a situation where one tribe took up arms against another. And when it was all said and done, they had, with machetes, hacked about 1 million people to death. It was just completely insane. But I remember Patrick Johnson had interviewed this woman, and she said this. She said, as horrific as all of that was, God was working in the midst of it to turn many people's hearts to himself. Now, we look at that and we just think, that's crazy. But that's so often what happens. So we, again, with God's sovereignty, we just need to get the big picture of the fact that God is at work. And his objective is not to currently create a super comfortable place for all of his people just to hang out in and have a good time till Jesus comes back. His objective is to get his gospel throughout the whole world. And even in the face of all the opposition that there is to it, he still will do it. He does do it. And so just remember that at any given moment, he can change it, just like he did here. Belshazzar, you're done. Babylon, you're done. Just that fast, it was over. That night, Belshazzar, the king of the Babylonians, was slain. And so if we know that, if we remember that, God can change it at any moment. And if he doesn't, it's not because we're bad. It might not be because we're not praying enough. It might not be any of those things. It might just simply be, this is the way God is working out his plan and purpose. This is the way he's done it throughout all of history, and this is the way he's doing it still today. And so we rest in that. I like the image in my own mind of falling backward into the sovereignty of God. I'm fallen, and guess what? God's going to catch me. He's catching me. He's there to catch me in his sovereignty. So we learn that. We learn from this story as well. We see that sin is not static. Sin always brings a decline. And so we see in Belshazzar, we see the decline. Nebuchadnezzar sinned and repented And you would have thought that Belshazzar would have learned a lesson from that and repented, but he didn't. Sin always will take us down further and further as long as we hold on to it. But like we saw with Nebuchadnezzar, the moment we humble ourselves before God, and he's right there to restore us and to reestablish us. And so those are the things that we can just forever trust in. One last thing. I was talking to my youngest son today, and he said something that was just really great. And it kind of fits into what we're saying here tonight. Talking about Jesus and how the disciples came upon, or storms came upon the disciples. Now, these were storms, you know, these were actual storms, right? And you remember, they were fierce storms. They were storms that were so fierce that the disciples who were highly experienced seamen, they were afraid for their lives. But the Lord helped them in the storm. And in some cases, he stopped the storm. Remember, he stood up and he said, "Peace, be still." And he calmed the wind and the waves. And everyone marveled, "Who is this man that even the wind and the waves obey him?" So in some cases, he stopped the storm. In another case, he didn't stop it. He came walking to them on the stormy sea. And the point that he was making was, either God will stop the storm, or he will walk with us through it. And I thought, yeah, that's a great reminder. He'll either stop the storm. So I think legitimately we pray, you know, God, stop these storms. You know, it's a good thing to pray those things. Lord, push back the evil. Restrain the wicked. Lord, don't let this evil prevail in our time. Have mercy on us. Stop the storm, Lord. But we know in God's sovereignty, he might not stop it. But if he doesn't, he will walk us through it. He will carry us through it. He will see us through it. And that's what we trust in.